Welcome to the Sports Equity Podcast. Here we talk to special guests from teams, brands, and agencies to discuss the value that sports brings to business through current trends and best practices with your host, Brett Weisbrot.
Our guest has been in the sports industry for over 20 years with a diverse background, spending time in all five professional sports leagues in the U.S., the WNBA, and now for over 3.5 years leading NCAA sales and service programs for universities under Learfield IMG College Ticket Solutions. Today, we welcome Marcus Madlock to the program.
How you doing, Brett? It's good to be here, man.
I'm great, and it's great to have you on. I'm excited for this conversation.
Absolutely. Same here, man.
Thank you. So tell us, you know, when did you first realize working in sports was for you?
When I got cut from the baseball team in college.
It's a real answer.
Hey, man, when I got cut, I was going to college to be a professional baseball player. And I transferred from Tarleton State University, which is a small rodeo school right outside of Fort Worth, to Texas A&M. I always knew that I wanted to go to A&M. I turned down an academic scholarship to go play baseball there at Tarleton. I wanted to build roller coasters. Aerospace engineering was my major in college. And I got to A&M and attempted to walk on after, you know, playing 2 years at Tarleton. And I didn't make the team. So, I technically didn't get cut, but I didn't make the team at A&M. And I said, you know, I'm ready to get out of school. What can I get into? And I saw Jerry Maguire when I went home for the break. And that's how the story started. And it's been a crazy ride ever since.
Yeah, I was going to say, coming out of A&M, you know, where did you get your first opportunity to work on the team side?
That's a funny story too, man. I reluctantly took an internship with the Texas Rangers. And I say a reluctant internship because I applied with the Dallas Cowboys and the Dallas Mavericks and their marketing departments and in their sales departments. I got a call back from the Dallas Mavericks and I did an interview there, but I'm not going to call the guy's name because he's still in the industry. But there was a guy, he's not with the Cowboys anymore, but there was a guy that was with the Cowboys that, to this day, it's, this was recorded. Today's date is what, January the 5th, 2021. I sent my application in 1998, I still hadn't heard from him. But I had a week, it was coming up on the deadline, and I had to select an internship, and a friend of mine pointed me to the Texas Rangers. There was a fellow Texas A&M Aggie there that worked in the ticket office. And he reached out to me after receiving my phone call, email, and letter. They told me about an opportunity in their box office. And so it's not where I wanted to be. I reluctantly took it because I had to have it for graduation. And it was the best forced non-decision that I can say in my 20 plus years in this industry that I took. That just put me on a course that I couldn't write if I wanted to.
And, you know, how would you talk about it? What was that experience like in ticket operations?
Well, I remember going to work and I'm like, man, I'm working in a box office. And there's nothing sexy about working in a box office. But once I got there, I realized my role was critical. At that time, the sales team, we had computers, so I'm not that old, but we didn't work on computers. But we had computers and they were selling. However, they would put their orders in the queue and they had an order form that was paper and they would bring it over to the box office and put it in the bin. Basically what I had to do was take the orders out of that bin and process the payments. The credit card was there, the check was there, or the cash in an envelope. And my responsibility was to process the payments of all the orders that the sellers had been selling that day. And at the end of the day, that bin had to be clear. And so that was my job. That was my responsibility. And I enjoyed it. I liked it. Then there was one Saturday before a game that one of the sales reps was unable to make an appointment. And he asked me to walk someone out and show him some seats. He had a poster on his desk. I was there early, and so I took the person out, and we started talking. He had a ring on his finger. It looked like my Aggie ring, and so we started talking. He started laughing. He said he went to that school in Austin, and so we started giggling and laughing about that. And instead of them buying the two seats that the rep had allocated, they actually bought four. And how we got to four seats instead of two, he told me that he had kids that went to school in Austin. And I asked him, so what is he going to do when they come? And I did not realize I was selling. We were just having a conversation. And they bought four seats instead of two. The following Monday, the guy took me to lunch, gave me $100. I asked him, what was that? He said, commission. And I said, I can do this. I said, this is what you guys do. And so I started applying for jobs after that. I was an internship. I was an intern. I was making $7-8 an hour. At that time, I was able to make some overtime. And I was an intern post my degree. And I had graduated. And so, you know, that was that internship. In a nutshell, that's what I did. And one Saturday, I took somebody to look at some seats, and then I was told I was selling the next day when he gave me $100 and he said it was commission. And I said, all right, I'm going to start applying for jobs, and I'm trying to find a ticket sales job.
You know, leaving there, it was more of a paid internship, but, you know, your first full-time sales role, where was that after this opportunity?
I moved to South Florida, work with the Florida Panthers Hockey Club. I sold hockey tickets.
And how did that opportunity come about?
I told you, man, after I walked out and did that with a guy, with one of the reps, his name is Ken Troop. And Ken is a staple in the South, in the North Texas area. But I started applying for jobs because I didn't want to make $7-8 an hour. And there was no opportunities there with the Texas Rangers. And at that time, Hicks owned the Rangers as well as the Dallas Stars, and our front offices merged, and there weren't any positions available. And I applied for jobs, and I applied for a job with the Florida Panthers. I literally applied for baseball jobs, hockey jobs, NFL jobs, all types of jobs that were sales, ticket sales, because again, I was naturally having a conversation, and the rep told me that I could do it. And so the Florida Panthers job came about. A guy by the name of Chris Gallagher. He was my boss. I remember Chris when we called and we talked a couple of times. He had my resume, and I'd flown out there, and he offered me the opportunity after we met, and it was great. Chris told me that one of the things that stood out was that I had Roger Staubach on my resume as a reference, and he said he wanted to call the guy who was bold enough to put Roger Staubach as a reference on the resume. And so that's a fun story that Chris told me after I had gotten hired.
And spending some serious time in South Florida, what did you know about South Florida prior to moving down?
Cops. Okay. The TV show Cops. Seriously. I had absolutely no clue about South Florida. Cops on Miami, the Miami Cops, Disney, what I had seen on TV, but I was born and raised in Texas. And so I played baseball, I traveled around, but I had never been to Florida ever. And the only thing that I knew about hockey was when the Dallas Stars had come to Texas. I believe that was in 96 or in 97. And so I grew up a baseball guy. I grew up a Dallas Cowboy guy, Dallas Mavericks, Dallas Sidekicks. but there was no hockey for me. And so I bought Hockeys for Dummy. I bought that yellow book, and just so that I can at least have an intelligent conversation about it. And I sold hockey tickets, man. You know, I sold hockey tickets. We sold them, season tickets. We renewed our tickets. We sold groups. we did it all. There are some departments now that are built out and have different segments for that. But we did it all as a seller. And that was in 2000, March.
And I know you're still really close with a lot of relationship from those days, but what did that culture look like? What did that, you know, sales team look like as a group, you know, from a day-to-day culture basis?
We were like brothers, man. Really, it was five or six of us max at the time. There was a young lady by the name of Lauren. She was like a sales coordinator. But it was five or six of us. We sat in the sales pit. As I mentioned, Chris Gallagher was our boss. He sat at the end of the hallway. and, you know, we knew what we had to do. And it was a matter of making phone calls and selling our season tickets. We sold suites on a per game basis, various affinity groups. And we worked with the community relations department, did things up at the rink in Coral Springs, you know, with youth hockey clubs and things on those lines. And we worked corporate. And that's where I found my niche. I'm very competitive. So when I got there and my name was on the board and it had zero, I had to figure out what was I going to do to get to the top. And nothing to take away from any of my colleagues. They were good at their jobs and they all had a book of business. But I had to figure out what I was going to do to differentiate myself and catch up. And that's when I got into B2B sales, man. I joined that chamber from a relationship that already existed there. I networked there in South Florida and Coral Springs and Parkland. I joined BNI groups, various networking groups, just so that I can expand my network. Instead of selling two and four tickets at a time, I was selling four and six tickets at a time with a 50 person group with a suite sale. And then I started to catch up with those guys and it was fun. It was fun. I was making competitive and it was like a big, like a brotherhood, man. Some of those guys I still talk to this day. I talked to one the other night and it's cool. And that experience is one that I will always be forever grateful and thank Chris Gallagher for the opportunity and seeing something in me.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the Coral Springs Chamber, because going to Snowman Douglas myself when I was at the Panthers, you know, as much as I was doing Fort Lauderdale and Miami, I still went back to the, you know, Coral Springs Parkland Chamber because it was kind of in my roots kind of thing. So I never knew we shared that chamber membership with each other.
Yeah, there you go.
Good times. If you could go back to this point in your career, is there anything you would have done differently?
Probably would have listened more and reached out to Chris and raised my hand instead of trying to figure it out on my own. He did give us the autonomy to do that. But when you try to figure things out on your own in a space you don't know, you kind of bump your head sometimes. And I think that if I could have asked a lot more questions, instead of trying to figure it out on my own, or maybe even just listened sometimes a bit more than I spoke, I could have avoided some of the pitfalls that I encountered. However, I don't think I would change anything. You know, I think that's what made me who I am and helped me to get to where I am. But if I had to choose something, that probably would be what it would be.
Hey, if you would have known 20 years ago, you would have created a podcast so you could work on your listening skills. So you move up to New Orleans after that to sell premium for the Hornets. Enjoy that opportunity.
My resume was online. With Teamwork. I had gone from an account executive to a senior account executive. I remember working with a guy named Jason Camp. I believe he was a part of our sponsorship department there with the Panthers, and network, and I found the lead and qualified it pretty well and passed it over to Jason. And Jason actually secured a banking partnership with Bank United or United Bank. I can't think of the name of it. I think it was Bank United at the time. And I said, I wanted to consider going into one of those roles or spaces, and nothing like that existed, or it existed, but there was not an opportunity there in South Florida. And so I just put my resume out there. And I get a phone call. I literally received a phone call from Teamwork Online, and I think it was from the NBA. I think the guy's name was Joe, and he said he was working with the NBA in the transition of the Charlotte Hornets to New Orleans, and they were creating a premium seating department and wanted to know if I was interested in the role. And we had a conversation back and forth, and after that conversation occurred, I guess something was going well, and they said, well, we'd love to bring you out here to New Orleans. And I made a trip to New Orleans, and I liked what I saw there. Apparently they liked me, and they offered me the job. And it was NBA. It was, you know, geographically, it was going to be closer to home. Not that I didn't enjoy South Florida. I did. However, I could talk basketball better because I knew basketball. That was a language that I could speak. But it was also hip hop. I love music, and I also love hip hop. And if you know anything about the NBA, you know it's hip hop. From a culture standpoint, it was just different, and I was looking forward to the opportunity to do it. So that's what got me to New Orleans, and I truly enjoyed it, man.
And we know it's football country, but you know, going out in the market there, talking to fans, and building a brand new in that market. You know, how did businesses and how did conversations perceive of the Hornets when they first moved, you know, to New Orleans?
We're like ambassadors, man. They loved us. they truly loved us. But the interesting thing about it is I came into New Orleans at the third or fourth quarter before they were about to start the season. And so what I mean by that is we were probably about 2 months out or a month out of the season starting, and they create this department and they want me to come in and be a part of helping to completely sell out the remainder of our premium seating products, suites, managed suites on a per game basis. And when I get there, all the companies that had some money had been tapped. Everybody had been tapped. And at that time, there was only one Fortune 500 company in the entire state. And so my first sale came from Alabama or Mississippi or Alabama. That's where my very first sale came from. It was a challenge, but because they loved it so, people were introducing me to people left and right. And I did find some opportunities where we were able to secure and close some business and get us to what we needed to be from capping out those premium seat numbers. But my very first Marcus generated all by himself, working, hustling, came out of Jackson, Mississippi. That's where it was. That's where it was. I wish I could tell you the name of the company, but that's where it came from. But I enjoyed it. I loved it.
And what's something you learned back then when, you know, that you practice selling and leading in premium now or ever since?
It's about relationships. Relationships matter. People do business with people that they like, but they also do business with people that listen and understand what they're trying to accomplish. If you're doing your sales processes correctly. And so to this day, it's about the person on the other end of the phone, listening, trying to understand and get a clear understanding of what they're trying to achieve and how, you know, what I have in my toolbox, whether it's seats, whether it's signage or any type of sponsorship, making sure that it's getting to the right person so we can get them what they want to achieve their business goals and objectives.
You know, and you mentioned earlier that a lot of the big businesses were already tapped, you know, but outside of having to be creative to find maybe other businesses to work with, what else would you say was your biggest challenges in that market?
There's just not a lot of money in the market. There's not a lot of money in the market. And so once you find it, you have to keep digging and keep digging and keep digging. It's there, but it's just not a lot. And so the pricing and everything was set where it needed to be. And so it was not as though we were pricing people out, but it was just making sure that we found the right people. And that's where the relationships came in and networking. You know, the Saints are going to be the Saints. That's the NFL. You know, they're going to have their target audience, but the appetite for basketball back in New Orleans, the NBA had done their due diligence, analysis and things. It was ready and ripe to be back there in New Orleans. And as you can see, it's still there, you know, it's still there. And they just added another team back in Charlotte, you know.
And I know you.
And yeah, Oklahoma City got a team out of it. You had a hurricane. They moved to Oklahoma City. And they brought the team back. Oklahoma City got a basketball team now. And so three teams from one that started in Charlotte.
That's crazy. So I know you didn't have Zion at the time. What was the team like when you were there?
Baron Davis, David Wesley, Jamal McGlure, Tractor Trailer, Paul Silas was our coach. We drafted David West out of Xavier. He was a baby face. And now he's a monster, in the league. And Baron Davis was a staple. I have a BD jersey right now that I got. It was authentic number one Baron Davis jersey, has Hornets on it. And so it was fun, man. Our very first game, the NBA did it right. We played the Utah Jazz. In the 70s, the New Orleans Jazz moved to Utah. And so our very first game back in New Orleans, the NBA put us against the Utah Jazz, and we won. It was the weekend of Halloween. And if you know anything about New Orleans, they love to party. And so for us to win, it was great. It was on the cusp in the eve of Halloween. And there was a rapper by the name of Lil Wayne. He was one of our season ticket holders. And after our very first game, Lil Wayne and the Cash Money record label invited the entire front office staff and the team over to their Cash Money mansion. And so after the game, it was pretty cool to go in and hang out with the players as well as Cash Money Records. And watching Baron Davis and Lil Wayne and Baby and those guys play Madden on the big screen PlayStation. It was nuts, but it was fun, man. And that was we were all family. You know, they welcomed us as we were family. And that's a story and a time that I'll never forget.
I'm not going to ask you what size a big screen was back then.
It was big. It was on a wall. And in their living room, they had a jacuzzi. So in the living room, they had the jacuzzi covered. They had a jacuzzi top on it. And Baron Davis and Lil Wayne, they were both on either side, and they were leaning on it, playing PlayStation in the living room with a jacuzzi sitting in the middle. Crazy, crazy.
So obviously, after all the years moving around here, you know, South Florida has probably become your second home of all places. You know, you make your way down there, getting some premium experience in New Orleans, having that South Florida love. You know, for the next 4 years, you move back to Miami Dolphins, down to South Florida. You know, why the move back at the time?
Relationships. You know, if there was a theme of this call, I would say relationships. I think I was in my second year with the Hornets, and every year I send out holiday cards, and I sent one to Chris Gallagher, and he had transitioned from the Panthers to the Miami Dolphins, and he called and acknowledged the card, and he asked me if I had ever come across a resume of someone that's in South Florida that just wasn't a good fit in New Orleans, but had some potential, shoot his way because he was looking to fill a position in premium seating there with the Dolphins. The NFL had always piqued my interest. Again, as I told you at the top of this call, you know, I wanted to work with Cowboys. That's the home team. And so when Chris shared that with me, I had already had plans on going to Miami to hang out with some friends. And there was a girl that I was seeing, and we were going to go to Miami. And I said, hey, while I'm there, let's connect, let's catch up. And while I was there, we did lunch. I stopped by the stadium, walked to the office, and I kind of bogarted myself into like an interview and a conversation about it with him. And I remember getting back on the plane, coming back to New Orleans, and I told myself, I'm like, I enjoy living in Miami. It was great. It was fun. And walking in at that time, Pro Player Stadium, walking into the stadium, it was amazing to see the palm trees. Again, this was in December, January when I went to visit with him, and it was perfect weather. It's why people live there. And we talked again, and the opportunity presented itself, and he laid it out there for me to consider. And I said, yes, I'd love to come back and be a part of your team. So I literally went back to work for the guy that hired me for the very first time. So I was excited about that.
That's great. And what was different in selling premium in the NFL versus NBA or NHL arena jobs you had previously?
There was nothing I would say that was, you know, different. The price point was a little bit a higher priced item with the Dolphins than there were courtside seats in a suite at New Orleans Arena. So the price tag was a little different, but being in South Florida, people enjoy their Dolphins. They love their Dolphins, whether they're winning or losing. They love them more when they're winning. But, you know, for those Dolphins that you talk to, they love their Dolphins, and they're always there for them. And so getting back into the market, I was a little bit more mature from a business acumen standpoint. And so, you know, it was prime. It was ripe for me to be able to do it. And so I got back there, and I think that was in January of 2004, January, February 2004. I had made my way back to South Florida, and it was good. It was really good. During that time, we saw a stadium renovation. Wayne Ozinga, the owner of the team, invested a couple, close to, if not over, $100 million in renovating the stadium. I watched the Orange Bowl game, Texas A&M, plug, giggle, whoop. I watched the game the other night, and where those guys played and what that stadium looked like, and now, based on what it looked like in 2008, 2004, night and day. Night and day difference. Higher price tag, it's the NFL. Instead of working 42 nights, I was working 10, 2 preseason, 8 regular season games, outside of the, you know, non-traditional working hours of networking, getting back into the South Florida business market and community. Creating my personal brand to help drive revenue on a premium sales standpoint for the Dolphins and the stadium.
And then this was in the earlier part of the Jared Grushka days, if I'm correct.
Oh, absolutely, man. This was before this was right at the birth of JMB Records. I'm not sure if many people know that about Jared, but Jared is the owner of a record label. And I still have my JMB record, Just Making Bagels, t-shirt in my closet. And so Jared is my man. Jared is my man. But yeah, Jared was a part of our team, a young lady by the name of Triana Tigerino. And the crazy thing about it was 3 of us. I think a guy by the name of Jason England joined our squad as well. But Triana, myself, and Jared, the 3 of us sat in the office, and we were our premium team. Premium seating team. And there was a guy by the name of Mackie Firestein that did some groups with Steve Bronner, and Rick Lassiter, all these guys. And I know you know some of them because you had the chance to work with some of those guys over at the Panthers when you were there. And so great people, again, family, camaraderie. And that was one of the things that Wayne Ozinga, he led with. That was the type of compassionate and type of person that he was. He was a businessman first. He was about his business, but he's also a compassionate, genuine, good man. And rest in peace, Mr. H.
How are you as a salesperson compared to this rest of this crew?
I'm competitive. And so when I got in there, Jared Grushka was the man. You know, Jared was the man. He's probably still is the man right now. But Jared was the man. And I always wanted to be like Grushka. I couldn't be like Triana because Triana was a female. And Triana was a beast, man. She was good at what she did.
So you mentioned Mississippi earlier with the success story starting off in New Orleans. What's a success story maybe from this time period at the Dolphins that you like to look back on?
Oh yeah. Miami Beach, South Beach Lowe's Hotel. At the time, Sean Hover, I believe he was a general manager. Again, you asked me what was a success story. Those success stories that makes such an impact, you know, people name, you know, details. And so Sean Hover was the general manager of the Lowe's Miami Beach South Beach Hotel. And he had purchased tickets by way of Ticketmaster, and he was on a single game buyer list. And I called the hotel, and he was talking about buying some tickets for the hotel. And you know, one of the things that I learned early in my career is don't judge a book by its cover. Ask the questions. Allow people to share with you information. You regurgitate that information back. And we had a couple conversations, went down to the hotel, did an in-person meeting. They wanted to buy 10 club seats. They bought 10 club seats on a 10-year deal. and they were sitting like on the 35-yard line. They were not on the home side. They were on the other side of the stadium. But they slowly began to work their way to the other side of the stadium as things became available. But that success story for me, I think was what opened the eyes to Triana and Jared that this guy knows what he's doing. You know, yeah, they knew that I worked in the NBA. They knew that I oversaw premium seating in the NBA. But, you know, if you think about it, I went from overseeing a department to being a member of a premium seating team. So from an org chart, I'm going backwards, right? Why would this guy come over here and he's going backwards, right? You know, for me, it was bigger, right? He's going from the NBA to the NFL. And so from an org chart, it is backwards. But I believe that sale gave me more credibility with my colleagues. Not that I needed, not that Triana or Jared says, all right, cool, you're in now. No, that didn't happen. But I believe when they saw me get that deal across the finish line, they're like, all right, cool. We got to watch him.
So who at this point had the biggest impact on your career?
Man, if I'm thinking about this during this time, you know, going from, you know, from the Panthers, Hornets, and the Dolphins, it would point to Bill Sutton. And you would say, Bill Sutton, you know, was he working for a team or anything like that? No, you know, I call him Doc. But Doc was a part of the NBA Teamboat. And if you know anything about Teamboat, that's his baby, you know. He worked with David Stern. But he was a part of the interview process for me when I was with the Hornets. And he sat in. And we actually did a role play. And, you know, he told me, Marcus, that was one of the better role plays that I've ever had in this process up until this point. And that stuck with me. And he's someone that I consider a friend. He's someone that I consider a mentor. He's someone that is on speed dial, you know, and Dr. Sutton, he just poured a lot into me. And I remember the Dolphins hired him for a project. And I had no idea. I had no idea. But he knew that I was with the Dolphins. And he came and he sought me out. And I'm forever grateful for Dr. Sutton, man. He's the man.
So, you know, from the time of the Dolphins, you know, you Panthers, Dolphins, South Florida, at this point, you're, you know, home, second home, what you call it. You know, you then take your talents back to the NBA, but to lead an inside sales department for almost 3 years with the Miami Heat. You know, how many bodies, how many people did you build that staff up to down there?
When we started, we got that up to 40 people. And that position came about. The outbound sales efforts, the account executive that sold season tickets, they had a retention team that a group sales department. I think they kept premium, but in 2006, they eliminated all their sellers. And so after 2 years, Shaq left. Alonzo Mourning was nearing the end of his career, and he was having the health issues with his kidneys. Mm-hmm. And so they needed to rebuild the ticket sales department, and they started it with an inside sales team. That's how they want to rebuild. And Mark Brown was someone that I had already known in the marketplace. because he oversaw premium seating as well as ticketing for the Heat. And he and I began talking. He told me that he was going to rebuild their sales department. He asked me if I would be interested in having a conversation. And so that's how that opportunity presented. But we got up to right around 40. And that was in January of 2008 or February 2008. And we began the quest of rebuilding and making it that season ticket base more healthy from a volume standpoint.
And then, you know, what is something that you learned to practice then recruiting that has helped you create a foundation for your philosophy even still today?
Every once in a while, I'll take a chance on somebody. Someone on paper may not look like you want them to look. You know, you look at a resume, you look at it for an experience standpoint. Oh man, they worked in sports, so they get it. Is working in sports something that is a career that this is a place in which they want to be and they want to make a career out of it, or is it the glitz and glamour of sports and entertainment? But there were a couple people that, you know, I made a recommendation to Mark and our team. Let's give this person a shot. Have they done this job? Have they done sales before? There were a few that hadn't, but there were some non-traditional people that we brought in, that had no experience, that didn't fit the typical, you know, fresh out of college, cookie cutter, what it looked like at that time. So we took a risk on a couple people, and they did well. We trained them and showed them how to do the job successfully. And so, depending on where I am and what I'm doing from a time frame of having to have the right people on the bus, I may take a shot and take a chance on someone that's not traditional or took the traditional route to get in front of me to do the job, especially if they share a passion with wanting to be successful in this business.
And what's maybe a consistent trait that you look for through those people or even the traditional person?
You cannot look at a resume and see work ethic. What you can look at a resume and see consistency. And so what I try to do is have a conversation just like this. I don't like interviews. I like to have a conversation. There are certain things that I look for. I want to see, I want to ask questions about their work ethic. I want to ask questions about their ability to work within a team. Because we're in sales, we hear the word no. I like to ask questions about resiliency and how they've overcome and how they've failed and stuck with a task and kept going. Because, you know, we will hear no more than we hear yes in the sales game. And so because of that, I don't want someone who failed at something and said, all right, cool, I'm going to put this toy down or put this novelty down and do something else. If it's something that you really like and you're passionate about, you're going to keep going even though you failed. You're going to learn from that failure and get better so that you can minimize failure and take that failure and turn it into success. And so those are the things that I look for. I love picking up the phone and having conversations from references. And I'll ask one or two questions and just hope that that person wants to talk about the person that I'm calling for and asking a referral. And if the person that I'm calling wants to talk about that person and me not having to dig, that's someone I may give a really good consideration based on a candidate pool.
That's great. And what would you say it was like working at the Heat at the time?
I loved it. You asked me that about everywhere that I worked, and I keep saying that I love it. And I think that's because I'm passionate about this industry. I enjoyed working with the Heat. The Heat was a very great organization. Mickey Arison, he loves that team as if it's a child of his own. And so the love that he has with his players that are part of his team and are like family, it trickles down to the front office staff and the way that he treats his employees. The same with Mr. H and George Shin, that was the owner with the Hornets at the time. And so the Heat culture, you know, I think that's a hashtag, and Heat fam is something that has been around for a long time. And not only is it a moniker and a hashtag outside of the Heat and in their social media platforms, but it's also something that exists within the organization. Great family, great organization that keeps it like family. And I loved it. Love it.
That's great. And, you know, I know you mentioned earlier you came in there kind of for the transition after Shaq and Russo. And if I'm correct, you know, when you were there as they signed LeBron with the big decision.
Oh, man. January 2010, Pat Riley calls a meeting. And every once in a while we would have a meeting with Coach Riley. But he called a meeting. And I remember going upstairs and everyone on the main floor. And he talks about the free agency period that was about to happen. And he said, it's going to appear as though we're not doing anything, but this is what we're doing. And he kind of laid it out for us. You know, we want to resign Dwayne Wade. You know, he's pivotal. He's a cornerstone. You know, he's our guy. And we want to bring in the best free agent on the market. And another free agent, the next best free agent on the market to complement Dwayne. And again, and the best free agent on the market. He didn't say any names, but we all knew he was talking about LeBron James. And he talked about NBA franchises that were dynasties. He talked about the Chicago Bulls. He talked about the Spurs. He talked about the Lakers. The Celtics and the Knicks, and all of those teams were built around three players. I think you could have talked about the Pistons as well, but you know, I remember those that I just mentioned. He talked about those three players on those teams, and that's what he wanted to build there in Miami. And I remember after that meeting, going back downstairs with our team, I said, if that didn't hype you up, man, I want to go get me some shoes and go out there and play for coach myself. And so I said, no, we got to get people to renew their season tickets. We got to get people to sign up and buy season tickets because I believe in that. And the free agency period came and it was like nothing was happening with the Heat. And we signed Dwayne Wade. Udonis Haslem got this crazy offer for the Dallas Mavericks. Crazy, crazy. And he didn't take it. We resigned Udonis. And we as a team got on a bus, went to Udonis Haslem's house. We all had T-shirts that said, we want you back. And it was crazy. But again, it goes back to the culture. We resigned Haslem, and then we signed Chris Bosh. And then, what's this guy LeBron going to do? And I remember going to a league meeting in Atlanta, and I was talking with some of my colleagues and the talk, where's LeBron going to go? And I said, he's coming to Miami. They start laughing. He's going to go to Miami. He wants his own team. And all I did was regurgitate everything that Pat Riley said a couple of months ago. Like, yeah, y'all know what you're talking about. And sure enough, Stephen A. Smith, at the end of June, says, I got a hunch that LeBron is going to go to Miami. Our phones didn't stop ringing. We had already hit a goal that the organization had set with regards to season tickets. So we had already hit this goal. We hit the number. However, we're about to take it up a notch. And when Stephen A. Smith said that, the phones didn't stop ringing. We went from selling tickets to taking orders, because people were calling. And then the organization clamped down. Hey, you had to be in the Tri-County area. You couldn't buy any more than four seats. You know, they clamped it down. It was crazy. I had one rep made $25,000 in a day. In a day in commission, one rep made that. Yeah. And he said, I'm taking my talents to South Beach. We were in that office. I have to send you a video. I still have it. Someone recorded it on their phone. And we just went nuts. We had a television crew in the office. We're throwing our pens up in the air, screaming, yeah. And I said, all right, get back on the phone. Get on the phones. The phones are ringing. And we weren't selling tickets. We're taking deposits. Four seats, deposit max per account, $100 per seat, non-refundable. And you had to be in the Tri-County area. And in 3 weeks, we generated over $550,000, 5,500 seats, non-refundable deposits. That was a waiting list that was probably bigger than some season ticket holder bases. And at the end of July, the same way I got my job, I lost it. We had created a demand, and I remember going upstairs, getting a phone call one morning, coming in and getting a phone call and said, hey, Marcus, can you come up to the conference room? And I was heading to the conference room. I saw my buddy Sean that works at security. I saw Sean outside the conference room and I dap him up. Well, yo, what's up, man? How you doing? I walk into the conference room and I was told that the department was going to be eliminated. Wow. And that, you know, and they had a compensation package for us. Teamwork Online had sent a representative to Miami to assist us in transitioning and looking for work. And now I know why my friend Sean was sitting outside the office. That was security just in case Marcus wasn't on his best behavior when they gave that bad news. But, you know, I would never say anything ill will about the Heat. I understand it now. At that time, it stung, but there's a huge liability risk that you take on. You have 25 plus people working, going to work every day and not having a job to do. We literally had nothing to do. We were sold out.
Right.
And, you know, someone could have said something on the phone. Someone could have had a workman's comp issue. Anything could have happened that could have had a negative impact and could have cost a Heat. And so looking at it in hindsight, understand why the decision was made. At that time, it stung a little bit.
I guess the positive side, it gave you a chance to move back home to Texas and lead ticket sales for the Houston Dynamo, the MLS.
Absolutely, man.
What was the biggest change for you in selling soccer, also adjusting back to a market like Houston?
I didn't have to pick up a book, Soccer for Dummies, because I grew up playing soccer. But soccer is not a traditional U.S. sport. It is a global sport. A lot of kids play it, but from a professional standpoint, it's not one of the bigger professional sports leagues. And so from a challenge for me was coming in and working, you know, in the NBA and NFL and having so many resources, you know, marketing efforts and things to help us to do our job at such a great, great grand scale. And then coming to the MLS, we had those things. I'm not saying that we didn't have them, but we didn't have them at the magnitude that we had them in the NBA and NFL. And so, you know, having to be more efficient and being efficient, more efficient, and having a rifle approach with everything that we do with precision. And that opportunity was one that I was presented. So we got let go at the end of July, and I had a conversation with someone about the opportunity with the Houston Dynamo. And I said, yeah, go ahead, you know, whatever, you know, put my name in the hat. And I was told that I wasn't considered as a candidate. And this happened in September of 2010. And then November, Bill Gertine, he is a consultant, sales trainer, reached out to me because we had him as a retainer with the Heat doing some sales training, said that he was in Waco at the Baylor S3 conference. And the VP had told him about an opportunity he thought about me. And I said, yeah. And I told him, hey, man, I put my hand up about this opportunity, but I said, put my name in. And sure enough, I got the call and I had the opportunity to go back home and work in Houston with MLS. I loved it. I loved it. Great organization, great franchise.
And how would you say this team differentiated themselves in a market, you know, with such big brands, big team brands to sell against?
You know how they differentiate themselves? They were winners. Not saying that the Rockets weren't winners, not saying that the Texans, nothing against the Astros or anything like that. But when the MLS decided to put that team in Houston, I think they won back-to-back-to-back, like two or three in a row MLS Cup championships. And so their fan base was fire for their team. And so we played at Robertson Stadium. It was a football stadium that the University of Houston played in. It's not the same football stadium that they have now, but it was a stadium that had no suites. Their suites was were in a concessions, were in a press box, and their premium area was in a tent that was air conditioned and climate controlled. And I was a director of ticket sales. And one of the things I came and I did was I said, I think we need to segment our sales team. Their sales team sold and did everything like when I started. However, as I evolved and I went from the Panthers to the Hornets to the Dolphins to the Heat, we had different departments. We had a group sales department. We had a premium seating department. We had a new business department. We had a retention department. And the Dynamo had eight sellers, 10 sellers, and they did it all. And so in amount of time, they allowed me the autonomy to segment the business. And the business is segmented to this day. And one of the things that we did was, that was also a selling point for me to take the job, was the team was, and the ownership was going to build a soccer-specific stadium. And we went from 5,000 to over 10,000, 11,000 and some change season ticket holders. And when we opened that new building, and at that time, we had surpassed the Rocket space and we had surpassed the Houston Astros base from season ticket base, their base of season ticket holders. In that marketplace, which is the second or third largest corporate market, behind New York and maybe Chicago or LA, from a population standpoint, third, fourth in the country, that was huge for that MLS club. And a success story that I can share with you from that time was when we went to the MLS end of the year awards and conference. And I will say this success story is probably the biggest and best one of my entire career to date. Was that year having, I believe, 10 or 11 of my sellers receive individual awards. To see them on stage, most season ticket sales, highest group ticket sales, most tickets units, most revenue. I couldn't have been any more proud, because I think that there was probably some naysayers that doubted our ability to do what we did. And for us to more than double our base, and to do it for 2 years in a row, that freshman fluke, but we did it twice, man. And great team, man. So that's one of the biggest success stories of all that I have to date right now.
And after this opportunity, I know you dabble outside of sports for a couple of years. You know, what kind of gravitated you back into the team side again?
The love of the game. That may sound cliche, But the love and the passion of this industry that I have. And so doing some work with New York Life and did some work with a staffing company. But I got a phone call from a friend of mine that was doing some work in the NBA and told me about an opportunity in Dallas. And I raised my hand to have the opportunity to do what I love in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I had always worked in this industry since college, but I'd never done it at home. And so to be able to do it at home, there was a pride that I had for a home team. And so I was so glad to have the opportunity to work with the Dallas Wings.
So WNBA being a little bit different and being a little bit of a grind in your day-to-day work ethic, what did you learn different in this role from opportunities you had in the past?
I pulled from the Houston Dynamo. I pulled a lot, but the one thing that I stood out the most was the equity that did not exist between the NBA players and the WNBA players. You call it economics, you can call it whatever, but there was just a difference. We had the same resources. We had Teambo, we had best practice sharing. All of those things existed, but it was just different, the NBA and the WNBA. And so one of the things that I just ensured that our staff, and they saw it come from me, is no one is going to outwork us. No one is not going to be as smart and crafty and efficient as we can be. And so that was one of the things that I just wanted to instill. And we did a good job, man. There are some people that I had a chance to work with that have gone on and are doing some great things. One of the guys I still talk with is out now in LA with LA Clippers. The guy the guy in LA with the Clippers, he's an Aggie. There's a guy that worked with the NFL in recruiting and work on the team side. He's no longer a seller, but he now works on the team side. I believe he works now with the Indianapolis Colts. And those are two guys that I still talk to this day. And then my ticket ops guy, he's right the road for me now. You know, I'm here in Norman, Oklahoma, but he's up in Tulsa working with the USL team. In Tulsa. And so just working efficiently and maximizing the tools and resources that you have and just, you know, just not let anyone outwork you and just working smart were some things that were takeaways and some things that I just want to continue to instill in the team that I work with there.
That's huge. So now more recently, you're leading sales and service teams for NCAA programs under Learfield. What's been, and we've talked about this a little bit before, but what's been the biggest adjustment, you know, moving over to the collegiate space?
Having to be patient. Having to be patient, man. In the collegiate landscape, especially working with a state school and even some with a private school. the priority in the NCAA and working in colleges and universities, the first priority is not driving revenue. That's not a college's first priority. Their very first priority is their students and providing a quality education, research, having the brightest professors to pour into the minds that want to come and learn at a higher level, higher learning level. And then when it comes to athletics, it's that student athlete, ensuring that student athlete has the best experience as a student athlete that they can have, working with our compliance office and all the NCAA rules and regulations and guidelines. And so the adjustment is one, having to learn some of the rules with regards to the NCAA guidelines and policies, because, you know, we work with youth sports teams and are able to get them out, whether they were 5 or 6 or 16, 18 years old. When I was working in the NBA or NFL or MLS, AAU teams and club teams come out to a pro game and and their coach can use a game as a teaching tool. But on the collegiate landscape, if someone is over, is a recruitable age, discounted tickets or free tickets, or they, you know, there's a lot of red tape, and things that you have to make sure that you're in compliance. And so understanding those rules, and realizing that college and universities, you know, maybe within the last 10 years or so, really started putting a dedicated effort to driving revenue, utilizing tickets and the multimedia rights space. And so pro sports teams have been doing this. This is, you know, that's their livelihood. And so the resources and tools that I've worked with in the past and strategies, some of them are just now being adopted on the collegiate landscape. And so for me, that's a huge plus to be able to tap into the experience that I have and to bring it to the table when it's appropriate and necessary to assist us in achieving our goals, whether it's here at the University of Oklahoma, where I lead and work with a team here, or with the University of Houston. I have a regional oversight as well as Stephen F. Austin, and sharing some of those best practices with those groups and any of my colleagues within the Learfield IMG Ticket Solutions portfolio.
And what do you like most about leading and developing people?
Watching them grow and succeed. I tell people all the time, especially when I interview them, one day I could be working for you. And there's a guy by the name of Jeff Iannella. And I remember sitting on an interview committee with Jeff Iannella that worked with the, at the time he was coming to work with us with the Hornets. You know, Jeff left us and went to Phoenix and made a name and left a legacy of culture, of great culture there with the Phoenix Suns. And now, if I'm correct, he works with SeatGeek and leading some of their business development efforts. But I remember when I was a part of the interview committee that interviewed Jeff, and look at him now. I could work for Jeff. You know, I could truly be underneath Jeff, but I sat across and interviewed him. And so watching people grow and succeed and taking on some of the things that I share and pour into them and then making it their own and them growing. That's what I truly, truly like most about leading and developing people.
That's great. Can you share some early success stories maybe at Oklahoma that paved the way for you to on some of these other properties that you mentioned?
You know, when people think about Oklahoma, a lot of people think about football and the success on the field. You know, there's some success in the history, you know, within basketball. but, you know, OU has success in national championships and gymnastics, both men's and women's, you know, football. They have their national championships. But I guess one of the biggest success stories when I got there was the growth of our Olympic sports. You know, I think in a year and a half time, we saw over a 30% increase in revenue in our Olympic sports. And our Olympic sports that's ticketed in revenue drivers are volleyball, soccer, men's and women's gymnastics, baseball, softball, and wrestling. We saw an increase of over 30% in that space. And so, yeah, I could talk about football all day and you know, we grew revenue there and what we're able to do in this pandemic. But the biggest success and that I would want someone to talk about, you know, the mark that I left in Oklahoma is how we were able to grow those Olympic sports, and those coaches and student athletes appreciate seeing a larger attendance at their games relative to that of being at a football game.
And what are some time management secrets you want to share with us about managing different properties in different locations?
Use your calendar. use your calendar and just being a good steward of your time and realizing that there is a finite number of hours in a day, and that you have to maximize them all and be efficient with your time. As you fill up your calendar, also put some time in there for yourself. You cannot be at the top of your game if you're not taking care of yourself as well. So, using my calendar and adhering to my calendar, being respectful of everyone else's time along with mine, I think that's very, very important. And when I do have someone's time and their attention, being a good steward of it and making sure that I come prepared, making sure I have all my I's dotted and T's crossed, and close it out with asking questions of what else I can do to help get you to where you need to be.
That's great. And now that we're in 2021, I try not to use numbers from the previous year, as we like to talk about being in 21 now. But how have you and your teams evolved, you know, with all the changes over the past year?
And we were fortunate. We were fortunate. We were blessed to be able to have a football season in Oklahoma. And what we had to do was pivot throughout this process. We truly, truly had to pivot. And so when the pandemic forced a work from home in mid-March, one of the things that Learfield, IMG, and Ticket Solutions had already done was at the top of the year, we transitioned to Microsoft Teams. And in January, we rolled it out and we had started on that platform. And so when the pandemic hit and forced us to work from home, we were already there utilizing a tool that allowed us to effectively communicate, share documents, and hold meetings in a virtual setup. So we were able to do that. And what we did was we continued with hope. And what I mean by that is we knew that there was going to be some changes. We didn't know exactly what those changes were. However, we operated as if we were going to be at 100% capacity, and we provided our fan base with a reassurance that if we were not at 100% capacity, what we would do is we would provide them with an option of either A, rolling their money over to the, and I'm talking here now football, rolling our money over to next year, which would be 2021, or making a donation of the monies that they apply to our program, the Sooner Club, and I'm Inspiring Champions funds that help our student athletes, scholarships, and things on those lines, or get a refund. And so we continued. I do know that there are some schools and even some pro sports teams that when everything shut down, they stopped. Their sellers were asked not to make any outbound phone calls, no email solicitations. We continued, but we continued proceeding with caution. We continued leading with empathy and compassion. And, you know, we asked, how are you doing? And it was a genuine ask because some of us were affected by the pandemic and COVID, whether it's friends and family. And so that's how we led every phone call and every conversation. And as we were having that conversation, and if the person on the other end, you know, gave us assurance that the pandemic had not affected their home or no one that they were tied to, and it did not affect them and their job, we pivoted and we talked about football. And that's what they wanted to talk about. That was the common thing that brought us together, and why we were on the phone in the first place was football, and we did well, man. We tapped out and sold out every game that we were able to play. We did not have a game canceled at home during the season once it started. We did have one game that was removed, and that was we played Tennessee. We were supposed to play Tennessee at home, but before we even got started, that game was pulled off the schedule. But we did every game. We had the ability to hold up to 26,000, and our team played well. We lost two early on, but we ran the table there on out, sixth in a row, Big 12 championship, and we won the Cotton Bowl. So it was great. Overall, great season. I couldn't be any more proud of our team, how they were able to pivot and continue to stay the course with all of the uncertainty that was going on around us. They stayed the course, they did well, man. We did really, really good.
So that transitions to me, my last question I had for you today, and talking football. How did it feel when you were asked to tape a voiceover for OU and you end up hearing it on the 2020 season opening football hype video reel?
When I got the email, I thought that they really sent it to the wrong person. When I got the email asking me about it, I'm like, who else could be Marcus and the last name starts with an M that they were really meaning to send this to? But when Jacob sent me the email and asked me about it, I said, sure. And I had never done anything like that before. The closest thing to doing anything like that was hosting a Zoom meeting and doing a voiceover for some sales things that we do with Learfield. But that's reading over a PowerPoint document. But I had never done anything to that magnitude. And I remember going up to Center Vision and going into the booth and putting on the headphones and behind the mic, and had emailed me my lines. And I read them, and they said, I will give a little bit more pitch, or say it a little faster, say it a little slower. I think I did it in like four or five takes.
Oh, wow.
And they said, have you ever done it before? I said, no, I didn't. I said, I was just excited about this opportunity, so I practiced. So they started laughing. And the Friday before the game, I got an email of the clip and sent me a little Dropbox. And I was like, this is crazy. I said, well, this is going to be played tomorrow as the team is preparing to run out on the field. And I was like, what? So I played for my wife. She didn't believe it was me. And she says, so what are we listening? Is that the pregame? I said, yeah. She said, oh, man, that's really cool. And I said, well, what do you think about it? Oh, that's nice. I said, that was me on it. She said, what? So she played it again, and she was like, oh, my gosh. And then that Saturday, I think it was September 12th or 11th. I can't remember. I think it was the 12th. I stood on the platform, and I took my cell phone out, and I recorded it, and I had chills. I truly had chills. Right now I have chills talking about it because the University of Oklahoma football, the fan base take pride in that team, in that school. And for me to be asked to be a part of that is something that I will forever cherish and say it's a hidden talent of mine.
Boomer Sooner.
That's it, man. Boomer. That's what's up. That's what's up, man.
Thank you so much for taking the time today. It was great, and we will definitely chat soon.
You're welcome, man. Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's definitely an honor, and keep doing what you're doing, man. I'm a big listener, and so to be a part of the people that have come before me, it is an honor. And so thank you so very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Sports Equity Podcast, where we discuss the value that sports brings to business. Follow us for new episodes on a weekly basis. See you next time.